The thing I love about Bernard P. Fife, Barney Fife, some of you younger people are like, who is Barney Fife? The thing I love about Barney Fife is he was the master of interrogations. He loved to interrogate, particularly Otis, the town alcoholic, drunk is the phrase I think they would use in the Andy Griffith Show. But if you go back, I was like rewatching some of the old Barney interrogating Otis moments this week. I was going to play one, but it's hard to find one in good enough quality to be able to play today. But there's some hilarious moments of Barney trying to interrogate Otis and get information out of him, particularly where his source was located, his steel was located. Did you guys ever see the one where Otis is supposedly asleep in the jail cell, and Barney decides he's going to go into his subliminal conscious and find out where the steel is? It's so funny. Go home and Google that episode if you haven't seen it. To interrogate someone means that you're going to question them, right? You're going to question them severely. Interrogate's kind of an aggressive word. We always picture like this aggressive kind of spotlight questioning going on. And the result of that is kind of the natural posture of the person who's being interrogated is that they are usually very defensive. All you husbands know what I'm talking about. You're getting interrogated and you become very defensive, don't you? The natural posture, the natural result of being interrogated is you usually become very defensive in nature. You're being accused of something. And many times it's something criminal that you're being accused of. And the goal of an interrogation is obviously a confession, that the person being interrogated will confess to the crime or confess to whatever's going on. It can be something very trivial. Last night there was a conversation that happened in our home, or yesterday afternoon I should say, of who ate all of the Samoan Girl Scout cookies. I have one particular child, my oldest son, Zach, who he thinks those are his cookies and only his cookies, and anyone else that eats those are breaching their space. Like Reagan, you know, has the peanut butter, what do you call those? Tag-alongs. Calm down. Tag-alongs. Chocolate Thin Mints. That's mine. And Toby's, evidently, since he ate an entire sleeve this week off the counter. Still alive, don't worry. Chocolate and dogs. And then Zach is the Samoan, so there's this whole conversation, like which we have to admit, like there's more less Samoans, it seems like, in the packet. We need to raise the ante. Where's our Girl Scout cookie representative in here? Oh, she's keeping nursery today. Suzanne McCool, like I feel like I need to just take stock out in Suzanne McCool because this is like she sells me like 150 boxes of Girl Scout cookies every year. And so there's this conversation about where did they all go? Like there's none left and someone had to eat them. Like they don't just disappear. I'm not sure we ever decided who ate them. Ashley, but the there's this kind of probing going on, a lot of accusations being tossed around, not necessarily criminal, but a lot of interrogating going on. One of the classic movie scenes of an interrogation is in the movie A Few Good Men, when Tom Cruise, playing Lieutenant Daniel Caffey, questions Colonel Nathan Jessup, who is played by Jack Nicholson. So it's an interrogation that's kind of forever seared in movie fans' minds, where he's trying to pull the truth out of the seasoned and hardened Colonel Nathan Jessup, and who blurts out, you know, like, you want to know the truth, you can't handle the truth, right? So an interrogation is taking place. And in today's text in John chapter 7, which is where we're going to be, so you can grab your Bible and go there. In today's text, Jesus gets interrogated. He gets questioned. He gets challenged. Now, let me say this up front. Jesus never discourages in the New Testament. He never disallows questioning. He never disallows questions. As a matter of fact, I think that is still allowed today to have questions, to have doubts, to have insecurities, to question and challenge your faith and your belief. As a matter of fact, John's gospel is kind of focused on that whole idea that we are interrogating Jesus. Is Jesus who he claimed to be? John, in his gospel, he kind of pours us into the story. And what we learn is that Jesus instigates these responses. the purpose of John's entire story. And again, remember, this is the best friend of Jesus, the insider, who's giving us perspective on the life of Jesus for one purpose. We revisited it last week when we jumped back into the Belief Project. In chapter 20, he tells us his purpose. I'm writing these things so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So he tells us this entire narrative, this entire story is about generating belief. And that's why we call our journey through John the Belief Project, because the goal of John is to create belief in the hearts of Jesus followers and non-Jesus followers. Jesus is the Christ, and by believing in Jesus, you have life. There's an eternal purpose why we have the Gospel of John, an eternal life purpose. And what we love about John is he places us in the story, doesn't he? Like, he allows us to live in the story. He allows us to dive right in. He brings us into the tension of belief and non-belief. He brings us into the conversations that Jesus is having with people who are struggling with this belief and unbelief concept. He brings us into the dialogues that Jesus gives his followers and the crowds. He brings us into these discourses that Jesus gives. Jesus will be asked a question and he'll launch into this long discourse, and we get to listen in on the words of Jesus through the gospel writer John. He brings us into the pages of the story, and we see miracles, and we listen to debates, and we see confrontations. And all of this is for one purpose, so that we might be brought to this crossroads, this intersection of belief. Will we believe in who Jesus is, or will we turn away in unbelief? He forces us into this decision of belief. And from the opening pages, it's been a while since we were there, but from the opening pages of John's story, we know that there's something unique. He starts his story very differently than the other gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He opens his pages. He opens his story in eternity. He tells us there's something unique going on, that there's an eternal God, the eternal Word who became flesh, that this eternal God got into our neighborhoods. He moved into our space, that this is a gritty story, that this is a story about a God who became flesh for one purpose, to generate belief in who Jesus is. And the story that John introduces is unique to its culture and its time. It's unlike any story that would be told of the Greek gods or the Roman gods, or kind of this pantheon of gods in John's culture, in John's time. All of these gods, these Greek and Roman gods, they were far removed from the earth. They were far removed from created beings. It was unheard of to think of a God that would enter into humanity, that would live in our space. If the Greek or Roman gods did enter our space, it was kind of like our modern superhero movies, right? It's like when Wonder Woman shows up and overthrows everyone, or the Incredible Hulk shows up and, you know, destroys everything. That was the picture of the Greek and Roman gods entering into humanity. They came and were superior. And then John introduces us to the story of a God who became flesh, who lived among us, who became one of us, who humbled himself. And Paul even says became a servant. And so we know that there's something unique going on. And John reminds us that he enters our space full of grace and truth. But this story of incarnation, this story of God becoming flesh, creates these contrasting responses. There's the tragedy of unbelief, and there's the triumph of belief. And John introduced us to this in the very opening chapter when he says in verse 10 of chapter 1, he was in the world, and the world was made through him. So he's the creator, and yet the world did not know him. And then he takes it even deeper. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, there's that theme, he gave the right to become children of God. So from the opening story, we realize that there's this divide that happens between belief and unbelief, that some people do not receive him. Even his own people, we saw last week, his brothers did not believe in him in John chapter 7. He came into his own people and they did not receive him. But some do believe. And John says, those that believe are granted the right to become his children. Now, the implications of that are very controversial, aren't they? That only those who believe in Jesus are given the right to be called sons and daughters of God. Only the people who are in that group of belief are called, granted the authority, the right to become children of God. Like that, those are controversial words in John's day and in 2018. But that's the story that John brings us into. And we see how this kind of plays itself out in the narrative, particularly with the religious leaders when Jesus approaches them and there's this kind of dialogue happening. And Jesus says to the religious leaders of his day, you think that you're children of Abraham, but you're not. You're not adherents of Moses. You're not followers of God. You're not students of the scripture. You miss the point because you have not believed in me. And Jesus is saying that to people who have devoted their lives to those teachings and those beliefs. Jesus is saying that to people that prided themselves in being children of Abraham and students of the Mosaic Law. And Jesus says, you missed the entire point because you have not believed in me. You are not authentic. You are not who you claim to be. And John positions us in the middle of this friction and he asks us the question, what will we do with Jesus? We are not left with any middle ground options. It is either Jesus is who he claims to be or he is not. Jesus is kind of set on trial. And as we walk through the pages of John's story, our unbelief is exposed and we are invited to believe. We are invited to live, to really live through belief. So last week in John chapter 7, Jesus was hanging out in Galilee. He had been for 6 months or so. Galilee was kind of the sticks, kind of the Lawrence County. I live there. Stop. Don't boo. I live on that side of the border. Jesus is in Galilee. And meanwhile, in Judea, in Jerusalem, in the capital city, there is a great Jewish feast happening, a celebration called the Festival of Booths. The Festival of Booths or Tabernacles, one of the three big Jewish festivals, and Jewish, particularly males from all over the region, would come and they would gather in the central city in the area of Judea, and they would camp out, basically, for 7 days. They would live in tents and booths, and they would celebrate. They would worship. They would sacrifice. They would reflect upon their time in the desert. And so as this time of worship and celebration and reflection and sacrifice, and it was at this event that people were expected to come. And so Jesus' brothers who are with him in Galilee say, hey, Jesus, this is a great time. It's a great time for you to show up and to shake some hands and kiss some babies and get in the spotlight like your publicity campaign's not working for you, and we're the new self-appointed campaign team for you. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to advertise and publicize. We're going to do whatever it takes to make you known, for people to see you and get the spotlight on you and get attention, because they had a bigger agenda. The bigger agenda is they wanted Jesus to establish a kingdom, an earthly kingdom. And Jesus said, no, I'm not on your timetable. I'm on a different agenda. I'm on the Father's agenda, not yours. And so what I want you to do is I want you to go ahead. I'm going to hang out here in Galilee. You guys go ahead to Jerusalem. I'm going to hang out here because I'm on a divine timetable. Meanwhile, in Judea, there's kind of this widespread whispering going on. The Jewish leaders are on the prowl. They want Jesus dead. The people are divided between belief and unbelief. Some are whispering about him. He's a con artist. Now he seems to be a good guy. So there's all this kind of undercurrent buzz that's happening. But the text says that no one will speak publicly about him because they're afraid of the Jewish leaders. They're afraid of the powerful and the scary. And so Jesus is in Galilee, and then suddenly, bam, we pick up in verse 14 in the story and look at this shift that takes place. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. Do what? Like Jesus was in Galilee, right? It's not supposed to be hanging out in Judea. And then suddenly, next verse, not only is Jesus in Judea, Jesus shows up in the middle of the temple teaching. So much for being low profile. Jesus So Jesus shows up in the temple and begins to teach in the center of all of this. All this buzz, all this controversy, all this where is Jesus, who is Jesus, he's a good guy, he's a con artist. In the middle of all this, this festival of booths, this celebration, this sacrifice, this worship, Jesus shows up in the temple in Jerusalem and begins to teach. Verse 15. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, "How is it that this man has learning when he has never studied?" Now, it's interesting to me that we do not have the content of what Jesus taught in the temple, but we do have the reaction, don't we? Like, the scriptures do not tell us, like, hey, here was Jesus' like three-point outline and a poem or illustration in the end. Like, we don't get anything about what Jesus was teaching. We just get the reaction. They marvel. They were astonished. Now, what amazed them? What amazed them was the extent of the knowledge of Jesus in light of his apparent lack of credentials. Now, we have to say, like, this is a common theme in Jesus' life, right? Like, as a 12-year-old boy, when his parents were like, "Where is Jesus? We're trying to go home. Oh, wait, last time we saw him, he was at the temple." And they go back to the temple. And remember what the 12-year-old boy's doing? He's, like, sitting down with the scholars. And the scholars are scratching their head like, "What are you, like a guru or a..." Now, what do you call that? What's that word where a kid like is way smarter than they should be? Genius. That wasn't the word I was looking for. Prodigy. Savant. Wow, I pulled that one right out of the hat. The 12-year-old Jesus is lecturing the scholars. And now we see in the adult life of Jesus, here he is, and the people are amazed. They are marveling, like, how does this guy know these things? How does someone so uneducated know so much? Did he stay in a Holiday Inn Express last night? Like, what's going on? The normal rabbinic process in that day and age was that a scholar, a rabbi, would be mentored by a great rabbi. That he would participate in a center of learning, rabbinic learning. We learn about Paul, that he grew up living in a center of learning. They studied under a great scholar named Gamaliel. And so people expect people that have this type of knowledge to have some type of education background. And yet Jesus is from the backwoods. Jesus is from Nazareth. And Jesus takes on the role of a religious authority, and he has no such credentials. And the people respond like, "Where did you go to seminary, Jesus?" Now get the irony here. The Son of God is the creator of the world. And they're accusing Jesus of being uneducated. Like, you see what's going on here? Son of God, creator of the world, sustainer of life. Where did this guy get his degree from? He seems like this guy has to be ignorant. He grew up in Nazareth. So there's some wordplay that John's doing here. Like, don't forget this is the creator of the world, and they're worried about his education. And so the people are marveling at his authority, at his knowledge. Verse 17, John puts us into the conversation. Verse 16. So Jesus answered them, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me." So remember, there's kind of this rabbinic succession. One guy teaches the next. This mentoring process. So Jesus affirms, like, yeah, this teaching is not mine. It's the one who sent me. And then he pulls the rug out from under them. "By the way, the one who sent me, if anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know where the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority." In essence, John puts us into the conversation to force us into this, again, intersection of belief. Jesus says, "Hey, I did study under a very well-known professor. Perhaps you've heard of him, God the Father." All right? Jesus says, "My authority, I do have authority. My authority is from God. My diploma is divine. It is straight from God himself." Now, we have to be frank. Like, this is a pretty unconventional way for Jesus to make his point. They say, "Jesus, where did you learn? Where did you go to school? Where did you get your degree from? Who was your mentor? What rabbinic school of learning did you go to? How do you have this authority?" And Jesus is like, "Yeah, I do have some authority. I do have some learning. Let me tell you where I got it from. God himself." Like, you can imagine how they respond to this. I mean, it would be like someone coming to me and saying, and me saying, like, yeah, you're a good basketball player. And you'd be like, well, that you want to know why I'm such a good basketball player? Because I studied under and have been mentored by Michael Jordan. Like, Michael Jordan has brought me into his own personal gym and mentored me and trained me, and I studied with him and learned from him for years, day upon day after day. Michael Jordan trained me personally and mentored me and taught me the art of basketball. I would nod my head politely and then walk away and be like, that dude is crazy. There's no way Michael Jordan mentored him one-on-one. Right? So kind of same reaction to Jesus. Jesus is like, yeah, I learned from a professor. I have a mentor. His name is God. God the Father himself. Jesus is not winning friends among the religious. And he does not back down, does he? He makes it personal. He says, the reason you do not grasp who I am is because you're out of step with God. You're out of harmony with God. You don't understand God's will. Jesus is saying, hey, I'm not some religious upstart. I am sent from God himself. His point is that their lack of belief in Jesus indicates they do not know Jesus, or do not know God. They do not know the will of God, or they would believe in Jesus. You cannot separate those two. We live in a culture that wants to separate those two. They want to have belief in God, belief in the spiritual, belief in a higher power, belief in something else out there, but they want to do it outside of Jesus, and that simply can't happen. You can't separate the God factor from the Jesus factor. They go hand in hand. You can't know one without knowing the other. Jesus doesn't leave us with that option, belief or unbelief. Verse 18, Jesus continuing to speak, the one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. You can see what he's doing here. He's hinting at the religious leaders. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true. And in him there is no falsehood. They're accusing Jesus of being a liar. We'll see in a moment a lunatic. And Jesus says, look, there's a flaw in your system of authority and your thinking. Jesus is not seeking his own glory, his own recognition. The implication here is you are. Jesus is saying, I'm not in it for me. You're in it for you. You're in it for your own glory. But I'm not in it for my glory. Jesus says, I'm seeking to bring glory to God. So what I have to say is true. It can be trusted. I'm on this divine task, this divine mission of obedience to the Father. And then Jesus unmasks the bigger picture. What's really going on here? Verse 19. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? So Jesus makes a reference here to the law of Moses. What's he doing? Well, if you've been involved in our story, you know that there's this big controversy that happened back in chapter 5. Jesus goes in and he heals this guy on what day? The Sabbath day. Not only does he heal him, but he says, pick up your bed and get out of here. Walk, go. And the religious leaders are infuriated, aren't they? They come at Jesus like, you've broken the Sabbath. Like, how can you claim to be a religious person? You've broken the Sabbath. And Jesus goes into this long dialogue about that it's not about the Sabbath rules, that we were made for the Sabbath, not vice versa. And Jesus says, the irony here is that rather than celebrating this act of healing, of restoration, the religious authorities criticize Jesus for violating the law. To which Jesus replied, here, for people who constantly violate your own law, I would hesitate to criticize an act of God just because it doesn't fit within the religious structure that you have created. If you remember back in chapter 5, when all of this unfolded, this guy being healed on the Sabbath and kind of this controversy that happens, the text says from that moment forward, they've sought to kill him. They wanted him dead. And here we see it played out. Jesus says, you're so worried about the law, and yet you're violating the law in its most basic, fundamental way. Remember one of the Big Ten. One of the Big Ten, when you think about the Ten Commandments, one of the first ones that comes to your mind is, thou shalt not murder, kill. Jesus says, you want to talk about law? You want me dead. Hello? Thou shalt not murder. One of the Big Ten. What's Jesus saying? He's like, you're focused on things. You're being hypocritical even in the keeping of the law. Now, Zach is at this place. He's 16. He's wanting his license. And so we've been doing a lot of driving in the car together, because kind of the way it's structured where we live is you can take driver's ed at their school, which is basically, hey, can you make it around the parking lot? Good news, here's a card, go get your license. So, like, that's not the driving test I really want my kids to be involved in. And so they pass, like, the school test. Then they have to pass the dad test, which is, like, we go out and actually do real-life driving. And so we've been in the middle of the dad test, and Part A didn't go as well as expected, so we're kind of in the Part B section of the driving test now. But I've been reminded driving around with Zach, one, he drives 1 mile per hour, but two, there's a lot of rules to the road that you forget when you've been driving a long time. Like, you know you're supposed to use your signal when you change lanes or when you do anything. Like, my signal is like the most unused thing on my car. But then I remember, like, oh, yeah, if you change lanes, like, you're supposed to let people know with your little signal, right? So, like, suddenly all these rules of the road. And so we're trying to explain, Zach, these real-life scenarios. Like, one of the trickiest ones is when you are at a red light without a turn signal, a turn arrow, just a green light, and you want to turn left, and you have oncoming traffic that's coming this way, right? So you're both headed this way on a green light. Who turns when? There's rules about all these things, right? And so I want to make sure that Zach, I kind of take all those things for granted. I'm not sure if I keep the rules or not. It's just like kind of give the southern wave, like whoever's supposed to go kind of thing. But I want to make sure I understand the rules, particularly when Zach is driving and I'm on the passenger's side. Hello. I want to make sure that he turns when he's supposed to or when he's not supposed to. You know what happens? We drive and we forget the basic rules of driving. You know why? Because we do it every day. We forget, turn on the signal. I got a ticket in Moulton, Alabama for not using a signal to change lanes. Are you kidding me? There's people killing each other and you're worried about me not turning on the signal. I love the police in our church, wherever they are. I love you guys. Wasn't any of our cops. That pause moment was brought to you by Bitter Devin. The point is, as we live life, the rules sometimes, right? Breaking the rules, we forget. We're living life. Jesus says, you want to talk about rule breaking? You're worried about a guy that was made whole and restored and healed, and he got up and took his mat, and that's what you're focused on, and now in the same breath, you're looking to kill me. You're wanting to kill me. The religious leaders are just looking for the opportune time. And Jesus fuels the hostility in moments like this. He says, you want me dead. That's a violation of one of the big Ten Commandments. And then John gives us this little sidebar in verse 20. I like how he does this. Again, he's telling us a story and he kind of gives us this sidebar. So Jesus is having this interaction with the religious leaders. Look what the crowd says. The crowd answered, you have a demon who is seeking to kill you. Now, what the original language is indicating here is not like Jesus is like demon-possessed. It's not like, you know, Rosemary's Baby, kind of like Jesus' head going to flip around. It's what they're really saying to Jesus, you're out of your mind. You're crazy. You're a lunatic. You cray-cray, Jesus, right? You're crazy, Jesus. No one wants to kill you. Why would they? You're a miracle worker. You provide unlimited bread. And Jesus says, have you been paying attention? Like, the divine agenda as work. As a matter of fact, within 6 months of John chapter 7, Jesus will be hanging on a cross. He's pointing forward. Jesus, who wants to kill you? Why would they want to kill you? Everything's good on the home front. Have you been paying attention to what's going on? They've been trying to kill me for months on end. Jesus dives even deeper. We'll finish up these three verses today. 21, Jesus answered them, I did one deed and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. I know you like scratch your heads like, what's that all about? Let me kind of fill you in on what Jesus is saying. He explains more fully what's going on and exposes the depth of their hypocrisy. So here's what Jesus is saying in summary form. The Sabbath law permitted a ceremony of circumcision if a male child's circumcision day fell on the Sabbath. Okay, so 8 days from the time a male Jewish boy was born, 8 days later, they were supposed to perform circumcision on that child. So if that day of celebration fell on a Sabbath day, the Jewish law permitted a celebration of circumcision on the Sabbath day. Does that make sense? So what Jesus is saying to the religious leaders is, riddle me this, Batman. Like, if a boy can be partially healed on Sabbath, if his partial healing on Sabbath can be celebrated, why should we not celebrate a man who is completely healed and restored on the Sabbath day? He's making a lesser to greater argument. Like, you're okay celebrating a Jewish male boy whose circumcision takes place on the eighth day. But you're ready to kill me when I have brought restoration and healing to an entire man. What's Jesus doing here? It's like his Colonel Jessup moment, right? He's like, you can't handle the truth. Like, you want the truth, but you can't handle the truth. I ordered the code red. That's what Jesus is saying. Now, I shouldn't compare Jesus and Colonel Jessup. What Jessup did was kind of sinful and blasphemous, oddly, but Jesus is not being that, but you get the point, right? Jesus is making the point, like, you have been so focused on the minutia, trying to get me, that you've missed the bigger picture of your own hypocrisy. You missed the point of the law. Here's where Jesus and the law come into play. John says in his gospel, Jesus came to fulfill the law, to bring redemption to God's people. Now, this flow of thought will open up an entirely different line of questioning that we're going to examine next Sunday. But let me end with a couple of kind of key ideas from this text. Because I know, like, when you kind of walk through what Jesus is saying here, you kind of scratch your head and be like, what is he talking about? So let me kind of lay a couple of things bare for you. One, I want to emphasize, like, Jesus is open to interrogation. Like, I know sometimes in our faith journey, we want to kick the tires and figure things out and scratch our heads and ask a lot of questions. And, like, that's okay. Like, Jesus is open to interrogation. He has been from the beginning. And as the message of Jesus moves through the pages of history, Jesus exposes unbelief wherever it is hiding. And that generates reactions. It generates reactions of belief. It generates reactions of unbelief, of skepticism, of questions, of doubt, and hostility. I even believe, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that I believe that unbelief, when it's completely played out, ends in hostility. Now, when you deny Jesus and continue to deny Jesus and unbelief triumphs, that eventually hostility takes place. You know why? Because the claims of Jesus are too severe. Like, they're eternal claims. Like, your eternity hinges on this belief-unbelief issue. And so eventually, many times, unbelief lends itself toward hostility. But Jesus is not afraid of questions. He's not afraid of doubts. He's not afraid of skepticism. He's not afraid of unbelief. His claims create those reactions in the unbelieving heart. That's John's entire purpose. His goal is not to make friends, it's to generate belief, to bring light into the darkness. Now, here's what I love about that truth. When Jesus is exposed, when he's interrogated, when we peel back the layers and say, what is Jesus really all about? I mean, because this is some pretty bold claims, isn't it? Like, I either am or I am not the way to God. Like, these are bold claims. So when we peel back that, when we peel back the claims of Jesus, what we might expect if it were me making these claims would be a lot of pride, a lot of in your face, a lot of I'm right, you're wrong. That's what you'd expect from me. Like, if I believed I was the way to God, like, and you peeled back the layers, I think you'd see a lot of self-centeredness. Like, it's a bold claim to say you're the way to God. But from the opening pages of when John brings us into the story and he lets us know that the eternal God became flesh, and we peel back the layers of Jesus and we open up the pages of the story and read in the footnotes, we do not see a Jesus who is prideful and arrogant. And in your, what do we see? We see a Jesus that John says is full of grace and truth. That he's both. He is full of grace and full of truth. He's not 50% truth, 50% grace. He is 100% true, 100% grace. When we peel back the layers on Jesus, we are exposed to a God, the Son of God, who is full of grace, not arrogance and pride and in your face, and I'm right and you're wrong and you're destined to an eternity without God. When we peel back the layers, we see a Jesus who is full of truth and grace. We sing the song that he's a good, good father. It's who he is. It's who he is. Now, let me end with this second idea. I want to talk just a moment about kind of this faith and truth and obedience tension, or kind of this fusion that takes place between those three ideas. So in the words of Jesus here and throughout the Gospels and the New Testament, there's kind of this fusion between faith and the truth and obedience to those things. So there's some phrases that you'll see in the New Testament that that kind of play out like you believe in order to understand. You don't believe, Jesus says, because you don't obey the truth. Your desire for the truth should lead to obedience. Obedience leads to faith and truth. So you see all these kind of ideas of faith and truth and obedience all like intermingled in fusion, and sometimes it's faith to obedience, sometimes it's obedience to truth. Like you see all these things playing out throughout the New Testament, even in the words of Jesus here. Here's the struggle. Faith is sight unseen, right? Like you can't put your hands on faith. You can't say like, all right, this is my friend God. This is why I believe in here. I'm here. Have you met God? Shake hands. Like faith is sight unseen. Faith is believing in an eternal, invisible God. So we have faith that is unseen, but life happens in the visible. Life happens in the current. Life happens in the now. Life happens in the flesh and blood. Life happens in the street. Life happens in the things you can touch and see and feel and experience. So you have faith, which is sight unseen. You have life that happens in the visible. And in the meantime, the gospel says, I want you to believe and obey. Faith that is unseen in an invisible God, in a Jesus who lived in history. Faith that's something you can't touch and see and feel and put your hands on. Life that is in the here and now. Life that is tangible. And the call of the gospel is, I want you to believe and obey. Now, that can seem kind of shallow. Believe and obey, like, there's a lot of big picture questions out there. A lot of unseen stuff. Like, I'm living now. Like, my marriage is falling apart. I don't have enough money in the bank account. I'm in the here and now. Like, how do I bridge these two worlds? And we got kind of this cliche answer, like, believe and obey. And it can seem kind of shallow. It's almost like the whole conversation is happening in American culture right now. Like when tragedy happens, like in, you know, thoughts and prayers. Like, is thoughts and prayers enough? And we do want to have thoughts and prayers, but there's kind of this pushback. Like, we need more than just thoughts and prayers. We need, like, action to take place, right? That's the tension we're talking about. Sight unseen faith and real life. Let me try to put this into perspective as we end. Our tendency as Jesus followers is to focus on the minutia. You know why? That's where we live life, isn't it? We live life in the details. And so our tendency is to focus on that. To focus on today and tomorrow and what's going on at work and at home and school and where do we have to be and what does the calendar say. Our tendency as Jesus followers is to live life in the minutia, to live life in the details, to live life just from the next moment. There's this kind of this, what have you done for me lately mentality when it comes to faith. Like, what has God done for me lately? What is happening in my life right now? And that's where the tension occurs. Because the call to follow Jesus is both a call to follow Jesus in the here and now, in the everyday, and also in the not yet. That it's coming, right? That eternity's coming. The heaven is coming. So follow Jesus in the here and now, but live life in light of the not yet. So there's a balance between the here and now, the already, and the not yet. The here and now, that's where obedience happens. That's the everyday. That's the step. That's the, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to make wise decisions. I'm going to do that in the here and now. That's the call to follow Jesus in obedience, in the now, the here and now. The not yet, that's where the faith happens, right? I can't see it. I can't feel it. I can't touch it. It's out there. I'm going to experience it one day. I believe it's going to happen. There's the confidence, the hope of believing in Jesus. Faith is sight unseen. And so there's this tension between the here and now and the not yet, the obedience and the faith. Here's where I want to bring in the gospel. Both of these tensions find their resolution in who God is, in the sovereignty of the God that we claim to serve. You see, what we believe is that God is in absolute control. Doesn't catch God by surprise. He's not sitting on the edge of his seat waiting to say, all right, what's going to happen tomorrow? I'm not sure. I need to try to plan ahead. I'm confused here. What's Devin going to do? No, that God is in absolute sovereign control, that nothing happens outside of his control. And by the way, I don't have time for this discussion, but if that's not the truth, then what is the other option? Like, is the other option he's not in control? Like, you see where that leads? Like, how do we know anything in here is true if that's the option? If the end of the story is not written, man, we might as well just throw this out, right? But we believe that God is in absolute sovereign control. And so as we live life in the moment, as we live in the right now, as we live in the tension of obedience and faith here and now and not yet, as we live in this tension of the reality of the steps that I take and the marriage that I'm in and the financial situation I'm in, as we live each moment, we are called to live as if God is in control. He's in control. He can be trusted. Whatever's going on in my life right now, God can be trusted. That's the faith step, that I will believe. I will trust in the truth. I will live in obedience to God, because he's in absolute control. So in the here and now, when my marriage is falling apart, when I'm having financial struggles, when I'm struggling trying to figure out how to parent, how to be a good spouse, how to love the people around me, how to be a great employee, how to be a positive influence, how to point other people to the gospel, as I live in the here and now, I live in the tension that God is in absolute control and he can be trusted in the moment. Here's our tendency. Our tendency is to say we trust in a God who's in absolute control in the bigness, but we're going to control the smallness. You tracking? Our tendency is to say we believe in this really big God who's the creator of the world. All things are going to work together for good. God's going to win in the end. Jesus came and sealed and redeemed and did everything necessary. Now, let me control this situation, this moment, this time. Our tendency is to see the bigness of God and miss the smallness of the moment, living in faith in the here and now. The fusion of faith and truth and obedience. Whatever is happening in my life, I'm going to rest in who God is. It's not blind, naive faith, as one of the early church guys said, is faith seeking understanding. Faith seeking understanding. I'm going to walk each day in his sovereignty. I'm going to trust in the big picture. I'm going to trust that he's in absolute control. And then I'm going to live like it in the here and now as I put one step in front of another. I can't control this situation, but God is in control. I can't change this person's heart and mind, but God is in control. I can't necessarily control what's going on in my parenting right now, but God is in control. I can't control this boss right now that drives me crazy, but God is in control. I'm not really comfortable in the job I'm in. I wish I had something else. I wish I had made more money, but God is in control. I can't control what's going on in life. I can't control what's going on in my neighborhood, but God is in control. Our tendency is to try to control it, isn't it? Yeah, I believe in God, but let me handle this. And the call to faith and truth and obedience is take each step resting in who God is. Each step, trusting His sovereignty, trusting He's in control. Even when I can't see it, I don't feel it, trusting He's in control. What's really going on in this text? It's an authority issue. Who's in control? Who can be trusted? Is Jesus who He claims to be? Isn't that the same tension we feel today? It's an authority issue. Can God be trusted? Can God be trusted? Or am I going to trust in me? Am I going to trust in Devin? Or am I going to rest in Him? Next week, the interrogation continues. But let me just encourage you, as you walk this week in the fusion of faith and truth and obedience, let me encourage you, whatever's going on in your life, trust and rest in the God who is in control.